It is Saturday, June 16th, 2012. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on Geek Speak, we'll be covering some interesting geek news and taking your calls with questions and comments about technology. The number is 800-655-5877, but that isn't for about 25 minutes. So first, let's do the news with Mr. Miles Elam, who's a software engineer and political junkie. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning.
Yeah.
One thing I did want to talk about was the WWDC. That's the Apple conference that just happened on Tuesday. New Mac Pro. New MacBook Pros. Something about the new MacBook Pros really kind of sticks in my craw.
What's the problem?
They're very thin, which is not something that sticks in my craw. They have a very high resolution screen,
yes,
which also doesn't stick in my craw. However, there are no user replaceable parts in this device.
What do you mean?
You can't update the RAM. The RAM that you choose to have in that box is the RAM that will be there forever.
It's, I didn't know that. You know, I have a story. I was going to talk about the Retina. So my next story is about talking about the Retina display and such. But why?
They're making it very, very small, and sacrificed modular, and a
slot to take a thing that can be removed is actually bigger than soldering it right down, mm-hmm, the board.
And in addition to that, the solid state drives that come, yeah, with them are in a format that is not standard, so you can't get a standard.
So you'd have to buy it from Apple if you do get an upgrade,
right? And they're not the same type as in the MacBook Air,
So.
Aside from the fact that you need a special tool just to open the case,
always been the case with Apple.
You can, mm-hmm, always open up the case, though.
Yeah, it's true.
But in this case, you need to have a special tool that is this pentagram star thing that is not a hex or a Torx. It's completely new type.
Now, so I didn't know this about the RAM being soldered to the board. I heard they had a new form factor for the hard drive. And, of course, it's not that it's different than the Air. It's different than everybody. I mean, it's completely a new form. That's the thing that's weird.
Yeah.
I mean, when
we
talk...
The Air is thinner than the new,
right, the drive is thinner, but it's still a serial-attached drive. I'm sorry, not serial.
SATA?
SATA, thank you. It's still a SATA. This new form factor, is it SATA?
No.
That's what I thought.
The connector looks like it.
Right.
Kind of like it.
I should say it's probably the SATA protocol, but it's a different connector type. And I don't even know.
Actually, I thought the Air wasn't a standard SATA drive. It was a
really?
Different.
Oh, my gosh.
SATA
I didn't know
as
that.
Well.
But they're different. The point is the Air and the Pro and the MacBook Pro are also different.
Yes.
So,
and the bottom line is you're not supposed to ever open it up.
You're not going to upgrade it.
Yeah. The Apple's already had a case where you can't upgrade the batteries.
Yes, the machine I've got doesn't.
Yeah, the last 3 years or so, you haven't been able, or 2 years. And at the same time, they really don't want you switching this out. In other words, it's glued to the it's glued to the top of the case. A lot of the parts are actually glued inside.
Right.
And in addition to that, the trackpad sensor is on the bottom of the battery, so if you really try ripping the battery out, you may end up disabling your trackpad.
Right.
Like, it's... it really
I don't know how I feel about this. I mean, that's the thing that kind of is disturbing, is that if, right away the machine lasts for a period of time and it's dead, you're not going to reuse any parts. Then again, I don't think I've used... You don't do a lot of modifications on laptops. They're so dense that it's hard to modify them.
You say this to someone who has a MacBook Pro in front of him, that he has upgraded the RAM and he has upgraded the hard drive.
Yes.
And he was looking at replacing
the
CD-ROM
question.
Bay with a...
Could you potentially unsolder the RAM and solder new RAM on? I know that seems insane, but I've done surface mount stuff before.
Yes, if you can find RAM that is of the same type. Yeah.
So what do you think about this from a perspective of... a consumer society that throws things away? I mean, that's how I see it right off the bat. The battery goes bad and the laptop's dead. I mean, that seems kind of insane.
Well, there is a case of if the battery went bad in your laptop, for example, you have a unibody MacBook Pro, You could take it back to Apple and they'd replace the battery and you still have the same machine.
Right.
And,
and Apple gets more money.
Yeah. Yeah, it depends on whether it's under warranty or not. But yeah. And at the same time, we're constantly giving advice on the show about how do you give more life to your computer? Well, add more RAM.
Yeah, that's true.
Hard drives fail. Out of hard drive space. What do I do? Well, you get a bigger hard drive because they're really cheap these days. And that whole path has been cut off.
Yeah. And now, do the pros have a physical spinning hard drive as well, or is it only?
I believe the new ones are just SSD.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Which removes that problem of drive failure in some sense. I mean, they still drive.
No,
they fail.
It does not remove the problem of drive failure. Although.
You understand what I'm saying.
It changes the equation because we don't SSDs are so new that we don't know what some of the newer ones, how long they will last.
Right.
But the thing with older hard drives is they started to go bad over time usually. Like, you get more and more bad sectors. And SSDs, when they fail, chances are, like, they just stop working one day.
Let's just shift into my story from this because I was going to talk about the Retina display and about pixel density and all of that stuff.
Sure.
Which is such a great topic for the radio, isn't it?
It looks so good. You should see a picture of
this. That's the thing is, it's so pretty. But that is the thing about this new laptop is that the pixel density, the quality of the screen is so good. Beautiful that it takes the computer screen to another level. Now, these are not the first machines to do this. The iPad has the same type of technology, and there's other laptops available on the market that do this.
And
kind
the
of
iPhone
thing.
Has the same technology, and Android devices. Many
right,
of them have very
multiple.
High
it's not an uncommon thing at this point, but it is pretty impressive for a laptop. I mean, I want one. I love the idea of that.
Right, we had never seen a screen that was this large.
It's the size of the screen. Yeah. That's the impressive thing. And so there's this whole confusion about how many pixels it actually has and how much what the resolution is. And what's happening is, and as you know from doing web development, Miles, the Retina displays decouple pixel density from resolution. And that's a confusing thing to talk about. But the actual screen physically has a whole bunch of pixels.
Right. Fun fact.
Yeah.
If you look at the W3C spec originally from way back when about web pages, pixels are not meant to be the single unit.
Yeah.
They actually were never defined as being a one-to-one ratio.
Right.
So for anyone out there and you're going like, oh, pixels have always been this way. Actually, they've never been that
Never been that way. But
people have treated it that way.
Right, but they've been synonymous in people's minds. And I'm just thinking about in CSS, when you're assigning font size, you know, using point versus pixels, the pixel in CSS, and I just want to ask you this, Miles, does it denote the screen pixel or the resolution segment? Do you know?
It's a resolution segment.
Right. So the PX in CSS is actually incorrectly labeled.
No, because pixels are not meant to be directly mappable to hardware.
Right. So we're talking about in software, a pixel is the amount of resolution the screen has sliced up. That's
right.
Would be a pixel. But the screen itself might be doing more. And
right.
The question I have is if the software is saying, here's a square that's, you know, or here's a curve that goes like this, the screen's not interpreting that curve. The screen is getting information from the OS.
Mm-hmm.
And so what's happening is there's a layer in there that can make content that's at a higher resolution, if you will, than what the resolution is currently set at. And that's the part I don't understand exactly.
Now, this is making a lot of folks out there a little nervous, going, wait, things are already complicated enough. Why are they making it more complicated? Pixels can't be pixels anymore. The idea that we're moving toward is that screens are becoming so much finer resolution that the idea of going from a 1024 by 768 to a
1920.
Yeah.
1200.
That doesn't make sense anymore because, as we found with Apple and their new release, people aren't going for the 17-inch laptops anymore. They're going for a 15-inch screen, or they're
right.
going for a small. Some people going for a smaller screen, going for the 12-inch, you know, that type of thing. But the resolution is still getting better. So
right.
the idea is: do you just say, "Oh, it's not worth it going up to a higher resolution," or do you make the resolution so much sharper, like in the case of the Retina display,
mm-hmm.
that it looks like the printed word on a page? It looks so much better, but you still have the same coding ability.
Okay, so here's the thing that gets me.
It's resolution independent display.
Right. So let's say we display some text. The operating system is going to draw that font, and it's going to draw that font at the resolution of the hardware. it'll actually color in the hardware mm-hmm. correctly so that it's the highest resolution possible. If I take a picture of you and I shrink it down and I display it, there's only a certain amount of data in that JPEG, period. Mm-hmm. So if I display it as a one-for-one in the resolution of the screen, which is actually, it's actually hardware, there's higher resolution to it, there won't be more data at the higher resolution. I won't see a better quality. If I shrink it down,
graphics, yeah.
That's right. So if I shrink it down, I will. So now we're in the situation where you have to kind of assume the size, and you have to do that translation. What's the translation in CSS? What's the, or you know, in JavaScript when you're dealing with the translation issue of that? If you want to have a higher resolution image that shows smaller, that actually physically on the device actually displays every pixel.
Scaling.
Yeah. What's the scale ratio for these things? Do you know?
The scale ratio for...
So I guess what I'm saying is, let's say I want to have a really, really beautiful button on one of these displays. Uh-huh. And I've drawn the button in Photoshop, and I'm going to export that button, and I want the hardware to show every single part of it. Therefore, I'm going to make it the image larger, if you will, so that the OS displays it smaller and has enough data to render it at the high resolution for the hardware. What's the ratio?
That's actually a very complex question.
I know.
Because, for example, I'm just going to bring up the iPhone 4 because it's been out longer and I've
yeah.
seen
yeah, more that's well, I think I figured we could talk about it that way.
Where the older iPhones, 3GS and below, had a certain resolution. And so you had pixels or icons that were something like 32 by 32, I believe.
Yeah, sure.
Something like that. And then the iPhone 4 came out and it quadrupled in size. And what you ended up having to do is make multiple versions of that icon. And there was a good reason for that, which is the human eye is not human perception is not perfect or right. is not as
and actually doesn't scale
as straightforward
the way
you might think. Yeah.
Right.
And so when making icons, you don't actually take a full size image and then shrink it down to icon size and
right.
use it because it looks horrible. You've lost too much data, and the human eye will see it just as this big smash of random data
right.
sometimes. And so what you do, and this is where a whole field of icon developers is out there, is that they are doing tricks that many artists know about for
right.
small
basically for working small on designs. How the human brain perceives imagery
right.
as the basis rather than the scaling of
yeah.
it physically. Yeah.
Use of limited negative space
yes,
or like
yes.
uses of contrast to be able to fool the eye into thinking that there are lines that aren't there or that they're sharper than they actually
right.
are.
You know, okay, so maybe we're going to stall out this conversation because, of course, at some point our audience is saying, what now and who where with the resolution thing? Because we don't have imagery.
But the bottom line is resolution-independent software is a good thing.
Yes.
That means that you're going to end up with the fonts are going to be as big or bigger. The icons are going to be just the same size, but everything is going to be sharper.
Right.
And
that's the thing that's interesting is that people keep on saying, well, the resolution is higher. And that's the tricky thing is that the amount of screen real estate out of the box is actually a little bit less than the current Mac I've got on me because the way the default is set to make the best looking high quality, right?
Right.
So the 12-point font is actually a little bigger on the, that's the best way to describe it, is a little bigger on the new Retina display, but it's really, really beautiful. I mean, in the sense that you cannot distinguish the edges and the curves at all.
Well, you can, but...
With magnifying, I mean, with it, I can.
No, if you get closer than, say, a foot or a foot and a half, then you'd be able to distinguish it. It's the idea behind that Apple's been selling anyway
right.
with regard to the Retina display is it's a... an indistinguishable by the human eye at the distance that the device is expected to be used at. So the iPhone is very small and you have to get very close and get a magnifying glass perhaps. An iPad is actually a lower pixel density than
right.
than the iPhone is. But it's expected that you're going to be carrying that, you know, a good
right.
9 inches
away from your face. And the laptop, you assume, what, 20 inches? 18 inches?
A foot, foot and a half, yeah.
All right, well, let's move on to other news stories, sir. Go ahead.
Okay, so one thing I'm going to bring up is the fact that there's this big kerfuffle going on the internet between a online comic called The Oatmeal and a site called Funny Junk.
Okay.
Funny Junk is this aggregating site. The users take artwork from all over the place and posted. The original idea was that people were making original artwork and then posting it, but a lot of it is copied from other places. Now, technically it's copyright infringement. But the author of Oatmeal is saying, you know, it's when people copy your comic, it's just making it more visible, gets you more publicity. And as long as you have a link or attribution to say this is where it came from, the artist behind Oatmeal, the Oatmeal, was saying, oh, that's fine. No problem. But what was happening was on Funny Junk, a lot of the users were putting up pictures where they were blurring out or cropping out or in other ways taking away the attribution. So that it wasn't clear it was coming from the Oatmeal. They were posting it as their own. You know, big copyright no-no.
Mm-hmm.
And because basically someone else taking credit for it, and like, so you, there's not even publicity for yourself. It just becomes a loss. And so he was telling Funny Junk, hey, take these things down. I'm putting up these, people are putting these up. You need to be more active about taking them down. And Funny Junk kind of blew him off, saying, this is the user's doing it. It's not me.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Oatmeal started making fun of Funny Junk.
Okay.
And Funny Junk, first off, took down the images
that were insulting the Funny Junk.
Well, no, took down the images that were copied from Oatmeal.
Gotcha.
And then filed the suit saying that there was defamation. And they were suing for about $20,000. So the webcomic was like, what?
You can defame a company? Okay, but
well,
go on.
Companies are people. Right? So anyway. So at any rate, so the lawyer who representing Funny Junk says, okay, we need $20,000, you know, for this, or we're going to go to court. Yeah. And the webcomic decides, okay, this is
ridiculous.
This is ridiculous. So
we're satire, baby.
And actually, he posted another comment. The guy behind the Oatmeal posted another comic that was suggesting that someone, it's not really clear who he was referring to, but someone's mother was amorous of Kodiak bears. Okay. So fairly inflammatory, but that's a whole other. So the webcomic decides, I'm going to raise money to fight this $20,000 thing, and raises $100,000. But what makes this a little bit more interesting is that the webcomic raised this $100,000 but has no intention whatsoever of paying Funny Junk and
anything.
The lawyer $20,000.
They're playing their own lawyer, I'm assuming.
On the contrary.
Oh.
They are the guy behind it. It's one guy, actually. Behind it is donating it in a mixture to two different charitable organizations, Cancer Foundation. I forgot what the other one was. And
what's he doing about the lawsuit?
Largely, he's giving the middle finger to that group. And the lawyer has stated that he is really surprised that there are so many people coming out by the internet, coming out from the internet, that are attacking him, lobbing verbal abusage, or at least written abusage through abuse through the internet.
Of the lawyer that's actually doing the suit.
Right.
Right. I'm not surprised at all. So what you're saying is online comics that are successful have a lot of clout. That's what you're saying, right?
Yes, although not everyone was expecting the Oatmeal to have this much clout. But
I'm not surprised.
People,
you know, the reason I'm not surprised, I've been watching the Kickstarter campaigns and different comics that I've never heard of before make serious money. Raising that kind of money is no problem. And it's kind of like, well, okay, there's obviously a large audience base. This kind of thing. It's, of course, possible that they're lying. They didn't actually make $100,000.
Right. But I have mixed feelings about it because it is basically mob psychology that has...
It's true. It's true. If you're popular, you win.
There,
that doesn't really work.
But at the same time, like, I agree with the Oatmeal stance. So it's this whole back and forth there of...
So, all right, next story. You've heard about Obama's Digital Privacy Bill of Rights idea, correct?
Vaguely, yes.
Okay.
I have not looked.
So, and we're going to talk about this in a little bit of vague terms, but basically Obama is suggesting that we have a digital bill of rights, which I think makes a lot of sense. We're always talking about this in the sense that as we embrace a new technology and deal with a new way of communicating, we don't actually have good ways of dealing with privacy and security. The UK, for example, Miles, you cover stories all the time about how the UK has ideas that it's your right to be forgotten, right? Your data that gets collected by companies should disappear over a period of time. And that's actually written into law.
The EU. More talking about that.
And so that's kind of an interesting idea because, like, right now, I am sure there's copies of my data all over the place on hold drives. And companies, it's actually very hard to purge old data. You have to build systems that you delete data instead of just collecting and collecting and collecting because it's easy to do. And so that law set is actually really about my privacy, supporting my privacy. We don't have that kind of law in the U.S. So it's kind of sad.
We do, but there are hodgepodge and they're very much weaker than they are overseas. We do have some.
Yeah. So I support government looking at this privacy issue and trying to figure out how to make a world that you still have the right kind of rights in and such. I mean, I get that. And right off the bat, their first meeting, which is set for July 12th, is going to focus around mobile apps. And this is the problem with these kind of laws. The dialogue and the debate is all about the current implementation of a certain type of technology. Mm-hmm. And it's rarely abstracted to a larger state. And that's the problem, is that you can't chase technology that way. You won't catch up. I mean, there's not the bill. Legal yes. systems not going to be able to catch up at any point. So I guess if they focus on this continually and always look at the next thing, that might kind of work. But how long have we had mobile apps and now they're finally having the meeting? So what are your thoughts about that?
As I've been watching mobile trends, the amount of people browsing the web and doing checking their email and stuff like that through mobile devices has – that curve is largely outstripping desktop devices.
Absolutely. So, they're very important.
So as far as the target is concerned, I think that's it's reasonable, especially
and they have technology like most of them have location-based information for the carrier. The carrier knows where you are all the time.
All of them do.
Right.
Because even if they don't have GPS, the carrier can triangulate your position from the cell towers.
So there's this inherent weird qualities about it that are very different than the home computer. A home computer was much more analogous to a phone at home, and the mobile device is much more connected to a human being directly. So I get that but they're focusing on the apps too. It just, to me, it seems like you legislating technology in this way is extremely complicated, and I don't have a lot of faith that the U.S. government, with the committees they form, can do it. Mm-hmm. And so to me, I just go, ugh. But then again, I don't have a better solution exactly. But
it can be a case of whack-a-mole. And you're right. I would agree with you that in essence, it's a lack of philosophy. It's talking about the mechanics of something without looking at the underlying ethics or the like. But I also like to think of it in terms of hoarding. You know, like people watch the TV show Hoarders, you know, and the idea is that hoarding is bad. So why is someone hoarding your information not even on the table? Like it's
right.
When you take all that information, you never get rid of it. That becomes
That was just one example of us being kind of behind the times to some degree about this thing, the hoarding information. I mean, the privacy rights issues is going to have a lot of sweeping statements, right? It's going to have to do with protecting your personal data in apps, what apps can do, how to notify the user of what they are doing. You know, these apps that you download and use and connect to your Facebook, and then that app is actually looking at your friends lists and then sending email as you. These things can take place, and there's no real – the only thing that kind of supports it being good kind of is the companies that are providing the service, and they're not looking at your best interest. They're looking at the best pocketbook. And so having rights in there, having legislative rights in there is very important. But I don't think it's something that's in any way easy to do. I think it's much more complicated, and it reminds me of this issue of – the systems that we have in place in our world getting to a level of complexity that passes the average human being ability to understand it.
And we passed that a long time ago.
Yeah. And you know, the retina story earlier, we were talking about this resolution thing. I've been someone that understood resolution perfectly for years, right? And one of the things I always said is, and the screen actually displays a little bit differently. But it wasn't really important because it's not something you had to focus on. And so the conversation describing resolution was something I could do. If I sat down somebody with an hour, boom, they understood resolution. They never had problems anymore on what size the picture should be and all that to print. And they got it. And I could do it. Of course, not on the radio, but in person. Now, okay, I can still do that. It's going to take me longer. It's more complicated. And I see that threshold emerging where I will barely get it. You know, that point where when you haven't looked at calculus in a while and you come back to it and you go, okay, whoa, and you're kind of catching up. And you're like, okay.
What was your substitution again?
Well, exactly. So you like kind of catch up to it again,
exactly.
But you see that, oh, mathematics barrier. There's somewhere there that I will get to some degree lost. That's happening all the time in technology. And the privacy place is already there. When I start thinking about and talking about the digital privacy issues, they are so complex that it gets daunting. It's like, oh, you know what? I'm going to go for a walk on the beach instead of talk about this. We're taking your calls with questions and comments about technology. You can ask us anything you'd like today on GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Mr. Miles Elam. He's a political junkie and a programmer. And we really would cover anything you'd like to talk about. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by the Cultural Council of Santa Cruz County, promoting arts, learning opportunities, and advocacy. And advocating for ongoing support of the arts. Learn how individuals and businesses can support the arts in our region online at ccscc.org or at 475-9600. We're also supported by UC Santa Cruz, celebrating the graduating class of 2012, including more than a quarter who are the first in their families to earn a four-year degree. That's cool. Online at ucsc.edu. This is GeekSpeak. You can call us with questions and comments about technology. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. I think that's it. 1-800-655-5877.
How long have we been doing this show?
All the pledge drive numbers are up. I'm looking around. All the numbers for pledge drive are up. Wrong number. But that's okay because I've said it twice and I'll say it again. But first, GeekBit, Miles?
Yes. Coldplay.
The band?
No. Well, yes.
Okay.
The band has done something very interesting with their concert, and it's that they've handed their listeners what are called Xylobands. They're these LED wristbands, and they're controlled by radio signal. And so each one would have its own ID. You send out the signal to determine what they're going to do, and they
react.
Yeah, and they do their color thing. And they have a variety of colors. And what they did was at one of their concerts, they had the entire audience sitting out there, and all of their wristbands were lit up, and they had them hold their arms up while it was lit up. And they turned the entire audience into a giant LED display. In other words, each person became a pixel.
Did they display an image, or was it just a coloring wave? What kind of thing happened? Do you know?
I'll leave it for... Okay, but let's come check our website.
Okay, but can we talk about the technology for a second? Were they able to address individuals? Are you sure they were able to address individuals? And were they doing it by location or by ID? Hard to say?
I would imagine they were doing it by ID because the seats were assigned.
Oh.
Right? You're told which area you're supposed to go into.
Okay, now I can see how they're doing it. See, the other way to do it is to calibrate the system with cameras, right? Turn people on and you find out where they are. Optionally, you could use the radio locations in that range to determine what it is, but then you'd have circular effects probably. Really cool tech.
It's not like you're not looking at a 1080p TV.
Right.
But it's still...
All right, so there you go. That's a reason to go visit geekspeak.org, our geek bits. They're fun and engaging. I'll put up one, but I'll mention that Daniel Christopher, one of the graduating students from the Digital Arts New Media Program, who I guess graduates today, did a piece that was very much like that in the sense that it was radio-controlled lights. And definitely addressable, but it is hard to assign the addressing to a map of space. So, any case, let's go on. And I just want to mention to you that there's a few more people that support us, but Cruise has Velocity Internet and Phone Service. Velocity achieves download speeds of up to 40 megabits per second with nationwide phone service included. More information is at velocity.cruiseio.com or at 459-6301. I'm Lyle Troxell. We are taking calls with questions and comments about technology, and the phone number is 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. And Miles, if you're not opposed, we'll go ahead and go to the phones right now.
Okay, I'd love to take phone calls.
Oh, good. That's so good. Nice. Jack from Scotts Valley, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure.
Hey, I got a question about internet passwords.
Uh-huh.
And, I've got close to 100 of them. I use, two or three different computers. And they're all different. Like, some have to be six characters with a capital, some have to have a number in it.
Yep.
You know, it's really hard to keep track of.
Yes.
And, you know, so my current system, I think, needs to be improved.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, want to try and get some advice on that.
The password dilemma.
Yep.
Comes up every once in a while. Miles and I had a fun time about a year ago talking about it.
Right, but this is also a separate issue, which is that...
The volume of them.
Well, not so much even the volume of them, because my sister had asked me about this a couple weeks ago, and my answer to her was you find a formula to figure out what the password is, and that formula is based upon the site that you're going to.
And the reason for that. So let's
it came up with a problem, which was the one that you were talking about, which is that some sites require 6 letters or more, some require 8 letters or more, and that's usually not a problem because you can just...
You just make it 12 in your set.
Yeah, you just always do more. But there are some sites that won't allow numbers in...
Or won't allow... Normally numbers, but won't allow strange characters like asterisks, and other ones require them.
Yeah, and some other ones won't allow the space character, for example, but other ones will. And it becomes very difficult to deal with. And in your scenario, you might just need some software as some help.
So here's another example of systems getting so complex, we're breaking out of the bounds of what the brain can handle. And that's basically how I feel about passwords at this point. And I'm in the same place. I have more than 100 passwords. And for a long time, I was using the same password in lots of places. I'd have like 4 different passwords. I'd have a password that was only used for financial institutions. And I only had like 2 or 3 financial institutions that was shared, and I felt relatively safe. I've got a lower one, and a lower one, lower, and finally until I had a simple one. But the truth is, that doesn't actually work, because my Twitter password, for example, was one of my simple ones, because when I signed up for Twitter, it didn't matter. And now it matters a lot to me what Twitter is. So,
because you're logging in with your Twitter account to a lot of different sites.
That's right. That's right. And so there's this idea that the best thing to do is have completely good random passwords for every place. And, of course, humans can't do that. So what do you do? And there's a few different solutions to this. One is, of course, is you just take all your passwords and print them out and have them on a piece of paper in your wallet. And that's your solution. Which, actually, I kind of like, because it's relatively simple to do. You can get a confirmation anytime you want. You can print a second copy and put it at home. It does require that you trust the people that engage with you in the physical world quite a bit, because you leave your wallet sometimes some places, you know. But I think that's probably a really simple, elegant solution in some sense.
The simple, elegant solution, from my opinion anyway, is to complain to sites that won't allow you to put in your a good password.
Because complaint is always elegant. You have to complain elegantly, though, right? Hello.
But the idea of not allowing certain passwords, because someone can figure out a really good password and just have and that one. We don't recommend that you have the same password for every site, but it's still better to have a really good password than to compromise and have a lot of really weak passwords.
Yeah.
But guys, my whole life can be accessed through these passwords, and I have a document on my PC where. I've got a list of everything.
Yeah, and don't do that.
I feel like that's really unsecure.
It is. It's bad to do that.
Right. What kind of software that will manage your passwords?
That's what I was going to suggest too. We're Miles and I are going towards the same place. I think on this, the way to do it is to find a software package you like that will manage your passwords for you. And Miles, do you use one right now?
I currently don't. I use the pattern password.
So. I use 2 different ones because I want to try them both out. I use this one called 1Pass. It's the number or 1Password. It's the number 1 with the word password after it. I have the app. I have an application on my laptop that runs. It has plugins for my browsers, and it also runs on my iPhone. And so on my phone, knowing my master password, which becomes very important, I can unencrypt the data and look at any password I want from any of my sites, copy it, and paste it. I also use it to generate random passwords. So, and all of these things sync together.
Yeah, and if you have a mobile smartphone, then I guess all smartphones are mobile.
Yeah.
Then there are also software packages out there that would work for both the desktop and for your phone and can sync together.
And that's basically what mine does.
Oh,
right?
That one does,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and the other thing about it is
that... be important if you have multiple boxes you need to worry about.
The other thing that's nice about it is that 1Password allows you to do a SSL web dev sync with the encrypted data. So my phone's... and my laptop and anything else that uses that account, it actually, all the data is stored encrypted on my personal server. So in the sense, and it's encrypted before it goes on the internet. So in the sense that I don't have to trust some company to not look into my code. Now, they're auto-updating my, or they're updating my app, the application they run on my machine all the time, so I have to trust that they're not going to modify the application. But in general, it's relatively safe. The other one that's really common, LastPass is the other one that's really common. And I run that one as well. I love LastPass's browser integration. It's very clean. When you come to a page you've gone to before and LastPass knows that your password exists, it highlights the fields that it can fill in for you, and you can say fill, and it will fill it in for you. 1Password is a little bit different in the sense that when you get to a page that it knows, it gives you a bar at the top that says, I can do this for you. But sometimes when you set it up, you set up at the wrong page. So it's a bit of management. It's a bit of software management. And I think LastPass is actually easier from the user's perspective. But it doesn't have the kind of security that I like that 1Password does. 1Password, basically, every time I've spent more than 20 minutes away from a machine, it requires me to put in my master pass before it fills in any passwords for me. So that seems kind of nice. You got any thoughts?
That's our personal recommendations, but you can also make an internet search for best password manager.
Yeah, you get it from that. Definitely.
And you get all sorts of reviews and screenshots.
And Wikimedia has a comparative as well of what it can and what it can't do. You definitely want one that's going to work on your personal phone, because it's really important when you're at someone's computer, if you want to get into your Flickr account, that you can find what your password is. And if it's randomly generated and you've never written it. The other thing is, you can also, from these, print. And I highly recommend that you print your content every once in a while. Now, of course, there's holes throughout this entire strategy on someone getting to you. But this is only trying to help. I mean, it's not perfect. You can't have a perfect security solution.
Right. Lyle is correct in that the human mind can't handle some of this anymore, and so we need some assistance, or we need to compromise somewhere.
Yeah. There's also a great discussion. If you're really curious about passwords, you're curious about encryption and that kind of thing, I highly recommend a podcast called Security Now. It will cover a lot of these topics. And the guy that does it runs a site called grc.com. If you go there, he's got a lot of free tools, really cool things. One of the things he has is this whole discussion about haystacking your passwords. And that's the idea that you just buffer your password, have your password be about 7 characters, and then fill it with a character set that's 10 long or something. And what that does is it makes it very hard to crack it with brute force. And then he also has a whole offline password system, which is very clever. And it's basically a matrix of characters that you use. And then you walk through that matrix in a certain pattern. And you start the matrix by looking up for, like, the domain name, like, say, geekspeak.org. You would, in the matrix, you'd spell geekspeak.org by going left and right, kind of like a crossword puzzle. And as you get to the very last character of geekspeak, the G on org, you then walk forward 10 steps, and that 10 steps is your password. And the only way to get that password is to have that piece of paper. And that's a clever way of not trusting the computer at all and having your passwords. But every time you enter your passwords, they're really hard, and they're completely random. So there's no way to have some, you know, memory trick. The last thing I want to suggest about passwords, and this is something I suggest all the time, is use a phrase from your life. And
better yet, go check out our passwords episode passwords where we talked about it for a whole hour.
All right. And so you were saying move on, Miles?
No, I was actually thinking, have we inundated you now with so much information that you're feeling overwhelmed?
How does it feel, Jack?
I'm going to go check out that comparison website, with the cost and that kind of stuff.
Well, Jack, if you're looking at it right now while we're doing the show, send a note to geeks at geekspeak.org what the URLs are, and we'll add them to the show feed. That'll help us out.
Okay.
Thanks, Jack.
Thanks.
Bye. From SoCal, Rich, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi, thanks. My solid-state drive just disappeared this week.
Someone stole it?
So is there any possible recovery? I mean, I tried swapping the SATA channel it was on, and the BIOS doesn't see it. It just went away.
This is actually a problem with solid-state drives, unfortunately. And this is an area where, unfortunately, I have to say I don't know of any easy way of recovering it, or actually I don't even know of a hard way of recovering it. SSDs, it is vital to have backups.
SSD is a solid-state hard drive, not a spinning platter. They're really great for power consumption. They're very fast, but it's a new technology, and we're not as good about it.
Yeah, I really regret having gotten it. I mean, not only is it a lot more expensive per gigabyte, I mean, I never found a speed test where it was significantly better than a...
Yeah, you know, what happened is the market, You know, the hard drives are amazingly good.
Like, yeah.
They're really impressive. And there's a complete different line of hard drives, right? You've got server speed hard drives and lower ones. And when it comes down to it, the new SSD market was so popular from a marketing perspective, people put anything they could out there to sell it. And all you need to know is that, oh, it's solid state. And you know the translation from solid state to pretty good, yummy greatness just happened automatically in your mind. So they didn't even have to really have really that great hardware.
Yeah.
And that's the problem that's probably going on is you probably don't actually have a fundamental like substrate problem with the drive. It's probably the electronics running it, the SATA interface that's on the drive, because it's actually those components you can kind of be cheap on. The solid state substrate, the actual medium itself, is probably only made by four companies or so. And it's probably all the same.
They also, those cells do have issues, and yeah. Some may wear out earlier than others. But yeah, you're right.
But a complete failure like that's probably the controller.
The controller is usually the problem.
So I haven't played with enough solid state. That's the other problem, is a lot of the geeks out here haven't actually solved these problems yet. They haven't figured out how to deal with this.
Well, one way you can mitigate it is you don't get just the cheapest brand.
Yeah,
there are some brands that are particularly problematic, but I don't want to shame anyone.
And also that'll shift. You know, if we stick a brand in your mind right now, in 2 years, that brand might be the best on the market.
On the contrary, I'm just going to give them a plug just because they've made really good drives, is Intel.
Yeah.
Intel has made really good solid-state drives, and they have
Intel normally puts their name on the higher-end products.
So,
well, I have to admit, I didn't buy the Intel. I bought this off-brand because it was like a half the price.
Can you describe, does this off-brand thing have a board that could actually be unscrewed from it?
Not that I could see, but I think I have nothing to lose, so I'm going to get it open somehow and see what's in it.
Yeah, because the thing with electronics is that, you know, the components that fail commonly are like a cheap capacitor will blow. And it's going to be surface mount. It's going to be extremely small, and that's not going to be an easy thing to find. The other thing is like a power conditioner. But it's not going to be easy to fix this.
Right, except for the fact that an SSD, you don't have the same cylinders and sectors that you do with a hard drive.
No.
Things are remapped so that even the operating system, you know, the rest of the computer doesn't know. Only the controller knows. Yeah. So it's...
But what I'm saying is that it's not like a hard drive where you've got a few different choices on what could have gone wrong. In this situation, we know it's electronics.
Yeah.
Because that's all it is.
Yeah, unless you hear a huge grinding noise, your hard drive, generally, you can get the data back.
Right.
But SSDs, get backups and get a good brand.
Rich, I'd love to hear your story, because what's happening is it's infrequent that someone has a drive problem on SSD, but definitely frequent enough where I highly recommend brand version.
No, actually, I have to take issue with that. A lot of people have issues with
what
SSDs.
I meant to say is there's not as many SSDs on the market still that are failing.
Oh, yeah.
What I'm saying is our knowledge base of how to deal with this problem hasn't reached a point where there's not enough I'm not getting hit enough.
We don't have recovery shops for them in the same way that we have hard drive shops.
That's the kind of problem. That's what I'm saying.
But yeah, there are a lot of brands out there that, unfortunately, it's quite common to buy a drive. And actually, I will shame one company, OCZ.
OCZ?
Because they were one of the first ones off the block to make really fast ones, and people got them, and they would fail within 1 or 2 months.
Yeah.
And certainly within 6 months.
Rich, is that what you've got?
No.
Okay, good.
But I mean, like, but they're not alone.
Right.
Well, I got another failure story for you. I was in China recently, and the battery in my alarm clock went out, and I found this little store, open front store, and they actually had one the right size, and it's cool. It says lithium on it, and I got it for only 3 yuan, which is like less than 50 cents. I thought, boy, what a steal. So 2 weeks later, it died.
Yeah.
Yeah. Stealing of your money. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks for the call, Rich.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Yeah, and just to put it out there, Kingston usually makes good ones. Crucial makes good ones. SanDisk I've liked. But still, if you're getting an SSD, back that up. Hard drives are so cheap, there's no excuse not to get a hard drive that is the same size or, you know, 5 times bigger, that still costs less than your SSD did.
Right, and make sure to do a backup.
And, yeah, do that backup.
And automate your backups so it happens without you thinking about it, and it forces you to do it. Todd from Santa Cruz, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hey, good morning, guys.
Morning.
Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Welcome.
So, I live up on the summit of the Santa Cruz Mountains, and our only internet connection was a very lousy DSL from Verizon. and I've recently secured an unlimited data plan and a Pantech UML 290, and I'm now running a home 4G network. And it's great that I'm getting download speeds of about 7 to 8 megabytes per second.
Uh-huh.
But that's going to get expensive.
Well, unlimited data plan.
Oh, okay.
Right?
From who?
Verizon.
Wow.
Grandfathered.
Ah, okay, good. There you go. I'm like, wait, why are more people doing this? Go on.
Okay. But here's been the struggle over the last couple of months. I've been trying to set up a router with the modem, with the USB modem, that will maintain a reliable connection even when I close my laptop.
So what you're saying is that the Verizon is providing this to this whole G4 network solution to you with a USB phone.
A USB dongle.
Right. And so you want to plug that into a router so the router can stay up all the time.
I have it plugged into a router, and I've used a series of routers. Uh-huh.
What OS are you running on your router?
When there's nothing connected to the router, it loses its connection.
That makes sense, right? They're terminating the call when there's not enough traffic. Okay, so you need something that's going to continually ping, basically. You want to do this so that it's always on?
Yes.
And you got to be able to do this with one of these Linux OSs. You got to have it do something regularly. How about setting up rsync somewhere with a short check rate? I mean, you could do that, right?
And you could, yeah.
It sounds like Todd can do that kind of thing.
No, I don't even know what you guys have lost.
Yeah, that's...
Okay, I'm trying to think of... So in your modem... I'm sorry, in your router, I normally install, if I can, I install like Tomato, which is an OS router solution. And those normally have extra packages that you can use.
Yeah, but those... That assumes you have the driver available for it. It's because those devices are not x86. I believe they're ARM devices.
Yeah, but you do get this memory. This USB stick is working in routers, right?
The USB stick works in routers.
Yeah, it's just that it shuts down.
And not all routers, obviously.
Right, but you've got some that work. So what you need to do is you need to have your router checking something every once in a while. That's what you need. You need your router to go.
I've got it set up to do that.
And it's still dropping?
It's got it set up with an active ping to 8.8.8.8, which is Google.
Okay.
Ping might not do it.
It still loses its connection.
Yeah, you may not be able to get it with ICMP packets.
Like ping wouldn't actually work because it's not high enough up in the stack to initiate it, keeping
high
it alive.
In the stack? What does that mean?
Well, is that the best way to describe it? I mean, come on.
No, you have UDP describe? Packets, you have TCP packets, you have ICMP.
So it's going to drop...
It's not considered a data packet. It's more of a informational packet.
Right. It's part of the protocol rather than part of the information. So what you need to do is get something other besides ping to be requesting. A DNS request would probably do it. A time would probably do it. If you get your time to check more often, that would work. How about that, Miles? Have time set.
I was thinking the most reliable thing would be to like refresh the Google page every.
Yeah, I don't think you get the browser. You don't think you get a modem to do that, a router to do that.
No, curl would run.
Oh, but if you did get a Linux distribution, you could set up a cron job to run curl. That's true. There you go, Todd. Perfect solution.
We're not talking. There's no easy solution that we can think of off the top of the head. You're going to have to get geeky.
So what you're going to want to do is the reason why the ping is not working probably is because it's part of the protocol and it's not considered information that's something you have to worry about. So the modem is still dropping those. You need to find some other protocol that the machine that your router can do that your modem will say, "Ooh, that's important," and have that do that enough. And I think that's the best way we could describe it.
Yeah, and Verizon is not going to help you out with this.
No way. Verizon wants to hang you up anytime they can, and that's what they're doing is detecting. In fact, they might turn you off. They might figure out what you're doing and then go, "Oh, we should terminate this call because that information is repetitive." You're trying to fight a technical battle, and they're trying to fight you back too.
I don't think it's a Verizon problem.
They're designing this so that Verizon wants the calls to end. because that frees up space. If everyone that had a system that they lease in this area, if all of them are on all the time, then you'd have a data problem. They can't handle that load. So they want their customers to only be on when they use it. And so they're designing their modem to hang up when traffic doesn't happen for a while.
Okay.
So what you're doing is you're going to try to tell the router to make traffic always happen. So that the modem thinks, oh, traffic, this is important. And that's the thing, is the ping's not doing it. I think we need to move on, though. Thank you so much. Good luck, Todd.
So you don't have another suggestion besides the ping?
Well, no. What I'm saying is I don't know what the other solutions are because I don't know what's in your router. You need to look through your router and figure out if there's anything else. The time, you can have automatic time updates. That will use a server. That might work. If you set the rate, if you set the checking rate a lot higher, and there's a whole bunch of things that might work, but I'd have to look through all your software.
I still think it would have to be something like web content.
Miles is thinking web content or email content.
All right.
Good. And you know what? I'd be happy to talk more about this. I'm very curious about the topic. You could give me some screenshots of your, or tell me what router you have. Send us email. It's interesting. Thank you, Todd, for the call.
All right, thanks.
Bye. All right, let's go ahead and take a call from, Santa Cruz. Hal, welcome back to GeekSpeak.
Hi. Quick comment on solid-state drives. I've been relying on them for 4 years now with no problems, and I'm in love with them. And I just bought a 60-gigabyte memory stick for $59.
Yeah.
And disk. So, but I do back up everything. Everybody should back up everything.
And are you getting high quality SSDs?
You know, they're both in Lenovo ThinkPads. I don't even know who made them.
Good. Okay. Let's.
Okay. My comment is that you repeated a discussion from a couple months ago, most of what you talked about passwords, and I don't see how the one single password is any more secure than having a file in your computer with one single password that
encrypts
all your passwords.
Okay, so that's completely right. If you have a file on your system that you encrypt with a one password, inside there's a whole bunch of text of your passwords, that is totally a safe scenario, very, very, very similar to these password managers. What the password managers do is they integrate and hook into your browser and auto-fill out the passwords for you. So instead of opening the document and copying it to the clipboard and using it, you actually have tools that help you. Additionally, it syncs it to your phone so you have it even when you're not on your computer. It's the convenience aspect that it uses. It's not really the actual security. The security of just having one file that's encrypted is the same as what these other apps are doing. And I'm running out of time. Thanks, Hal, for the clarification. I appreciate that. Definitely. It was a good clarification. Thank you. Let's close up the show. This is GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. With me in the Arum was Mr. Miles Elam. Thank you, Miles, very much for being here
today.
Always
a pleasure.
This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and broadcasting at kosp.org. Coming up next is Car Talk, and Car Talk is made possible by a grant from Burger, on the corner of Bay and Mission Streets in Westside Santa Cruz, featuring gourmet burgers made with California grass-fed beef and 50 craft beers on tap. Burger's menu also includes wood-fried pizza, specialty salads, and milkshakes. Hours, menus, and event listings at burgersantacruz.com.